therapeutic services for Sinai. Just a little aside, no disrespect to Jonathan Cooper. When Kulanu was searching out for its director of programming, Gil was actually one of our candidates. And he was at Sinai at the time, and I felt very bad offering him a position, but of course I spoke to Lorette, and turns out Gil is still at Sinai, and thank God we found Jonathan. It all worked out, and together as a team,
two pillars, correct,
and they've worked together to make this presentation today. I want to thank both of you, and I'm glad that you got to meet each other and work together, and hopefully together we'll continue to build this wonderful these wonderful organizations. And Gil El-Malay, Dr. Gil El-Malay, thank you.
Let me begin by saying thank you to Rabbi Billet and Rabbi Dworkin for allowing this panel to take place today and to raise issues that our community has and raise issues about people with disabilities. I'm going to be speaking a little bit about Sinai Special Needs Institute later on in my presentation, but I want to take a moment to publicly give hakarta tov to Lorette Rothweck, who is sitting by my side, for giving me the opportunity to address you today and for helping make this forum a reality. I also want to acknowledge the presence of Robert Prozanski, who is a member of the RCBC of Bergen County and who is a support member also of Project SELF, and I will speak a little bit about that later on, and acknowledge the presence of Rebbetzin Miriam Berry, who is a director of one of the directors of the Sephardic Bikacholim, but is also a very big advocate for children with disabilities and other children, Sephardic children, in Brooklyn as well. I want to read some words that I have heard many times from you in different types of experiences and environments. The words come from the introduction of Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato in Misilat Yesharim. I have written this work not to teach men what they do not know, but to remind them of what they already know and is very evident to them. For you will find in most of my words only things which most people know and concerning which they entertain no doubts. But to the extent that they are well known and their truths revealed to all, so is forgetfulness in relation to them extremely prevalent. It follows then that the benefit obtained from this work is not derived from a single reading, for it is possible that the reader will find that he has learned little after having read it and that he did not know it before. Its benefit is to be derived through review and persistent study, by which one is reminded of those things which by nature he is prone to forget and through which he is caused to take to heart the duty that he tends to overlook. I'm hoping that the presentations that you've heard thus far are things that you already know and things that you have tended to forget. And furthermore, I'm hoping that the presentation that you will hear now will act as a source of chizuk to some of the things and some of the vulnerabilities that is happening to our children. I was debating in the beginning of this morning's panel whether I should even bother using the multimedia because of the crowd, the size of the crowd here. But I'm going to take Rabbi Billet's invitation to give you a full presentation, because I'm going to ask you to note and to think not only in terms of people who have disabilities, but to think of children, to put faces, to put smiles, to put hearts and souls into the terminology that we are using and what I'm going to be discussing today. The definition of vulnerability, thank you, is capable of being wounded or hurt. Someone who is difficult to defend. I'm here to address the topic of vulnerability of special needs individuals, a topic which is so complex and broad that in rabbis' terms will probably take me at least 10, if not 20, drashot Shabbos sermons to cover. Instead of providing you with a very ambiguous and large analysis of the problem, I thought today I would share with you a few moments of one specific problem, the problem that faces children with disabilities and children who do not have disabilities, and that is the problem of sexual abuse in our community. What I would like to do today is discuss with you some statistics and prevalence of what sexual abuse is. We'll be speaking about why children with disabilities have a very special vulnerability to this problem. We'll speak about Sinai and what Sinai did to try to give chizuk to our children, Project Self. And finally, we'll leave you with a note of how you can help us continuing on. What I would also like to do, if I can have your help, is read you some words that were written by David Mandel, who is the CEO of Ohel. And you can follow along in the handout. He says about the problem of sexual abuse in our community the following. Problem? What problem? Virtually every discussion on child molestation includes a commentary on the inability or unwillingness by our community to acknowledge or discuss these issues. This is understandable. The subject makes us uncomfortable. We have difficulty comprehending such an action by any Jew, let alone an Orthodox Jew and someone we know. 20 years ago, when parents gave birth to a child with mental retardation or a 10-year-old diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder, the prevalent response by the child's parents was to hide it from the neighbors. The problem with this, of course, was that it was much more difficult for these parents to obtain the best treatment. Few programs exist for a problem that does not exist. Over the last 20 years, our Orthodox community has developed and supports a host of programs to serve children and adults with disabilities, mental retardation, psychiatric disorders, and other special needs. We have recognized that people with special needs can learn, can lead fulfilling lives, and can even be good neighbors, as stated in some of the presentations that we have heard thus far. There are scores, yes, scores of molesters in our midst throughout the Orthodox Jewish communities. We face the issue of child molestation and sexual abuse today in our community. How and why should anyone develop a treatment for a problem that people say does not really exist or will barely acknowledge? Could you imagine what it would be like today if cancer was not acknowledged and researchers and pharmaceutical companies did not develop medication and treatment? It is only by understanding what a problem is that a person then work on finding the best solution. The problem is that our population, our special needs population, children who have disabilities, our special friends, they are vulnerable. They are vulnerable to sexual abuse and sexual molestation. I once met a rabbi who said to me that the field of psychology and mental health in general is very fluffy, very emotional. Of course, now anyone associated with the RCA. But it led me to discuss this issue with backing it up with statistics. And what I'd like to do for the next few moments is show you exactly what is going on in our society. Every day, three children are murdered by a parent or caretaker. 18,000 become disabled every year. Over 500,000 are seriously injured every year. 3 million children were reported as victims of child abuse in 1999. That number only grows. One in four female children will be molested by age 18. And the reason why I paused before I read that is because recently I was speaking about the problem of child sexual abuse to a very large audience. We had about 100 people. 95% were women. And I was wondering to myself when I mentioned this, who was I going to be affecting? One in six males will be molested by age 18. 80 to 90% of sexual abuse offenders are family members or close friends of the family. It is estimated that 28 million children will be sexually abused in the next decade. Only 5% of sexually abused girls ever report that abuse has ever happened. We continue. Up to 45% of incident offenders use force or the threat of force during an assault. Studies including 5,000 offenders show that there is no documentation of a typical offender, which means that anyone can offend. It doesn't have to be someone who looks like they might be a predator. It could literally be anyone. How do they do it? Grooming a child for sexual abuse is almost a universal phenomenon where trust is first built up and then betrayed. And as I say and state the statistic, look at our special friends and think about how do they react to trust? How do they react to friendship? How do they react to love? When we open up our hands, they are the first ones to hold on to our hands. As many as 21 to 40% of sexual abuse victims may show no symptomology, which means that although the abuse has taken place, we never will know what happened. 50% of child victims are molested in their own home or the home of a trusted offender. 25% of men in prison are there because of criminal sexual offenses. And obviously, underreporting of abuse continues to be a problem. This is statistics from the non-Jewish world. If we think that they underreport, at comma of a comma, in our own Jewish communities, do we underreport as well? About a year and a half ago, there was a very shocking story, a story that I shared with the RCBC that was actually shown on Channel 4. And it spoke about how even though the Jewish community is sheltered and is very isolated, it is not immune. And someone from the media got hold of a report of certain sexual abuses that were taking place in Brooklyn. And what I'm going to do is, because I know that some people here may not own a television, may not watch TV, I'm actually going to show you the clip so that you can see it for yourselves.
Rabbi Rottenberg declined to appear on camera, saying by phone he doesn't believe a word of the allegation. like his client declined to be interviewed, says Hofner is absolutely and totally innocent. But speech pathologist Adele Markham, who worked with the child since he was a toddler, says she noticed something wrong soon after Hofner began to tutor him.
He seemed to be daydreaming and seemed to be distracted to only toddlers and
as for those who threatened to kill the boy's family for cooperating with the DA, Robert Kirk, who runs the rabbinic seminary at Yeshiva University, says they are misguided about Jewish law.
People have to know that the Hufudim is a socialism. That the community deals with problems best when they address them and not when they cover them. And that while it takes courage, courage is more advocated than Jewish tradition and cowardice.
Brooklyn DA Charles Hines adds, if he catches whomever is threatening the boy's family, he'll prosecute that too. Rabbi Hofner is free on $100,000 bail, while he's charged by the DA. Sources close to the investigation say Hofner has not been indicted by the grand jury, which continues to review the case. Officials at the Bavel Yeshiva, which also runs the summer camp where Hofner has been a counselor, declined repeated requests for comment.
The next question we need to ask is, what makes our children vulnerable? First problem is that they lack sexual knowledge, in the sense that most of our children probably pick up some knowledge in the community, going through movies, magazines, newspapers, talking to friends. They don't have the type of knowledge to work with. And therefore, when somebody confronts them, they really do not understand that whatever it is that they're doing is a sexual act. They don't have that. What they think is, they think it's friendship, and they think it's attention, and they think it's caring, and they think it's love. Number two, some of our children have problems with impulse control. And what happens is that they tend to, their cognitive functioning tends to be inhibited, which means, I think it, therefore I do it. And I'll give you a perfect example that was related to me by a parent who said that they were walking with their child. They got into one of the buses in Teaneck, and basically the child sat down next to them, and a beautiful blonde lady walked up and sat right next to this child. Well, this child, in a very natural way, thought about how beautiful this person is, and then therefore acted on it as well with his hands. It's not that they do it because they are predators themselves, but because they do not know. Some of our children lack appropriate socialization and personal boundaries. And if some of you have ever had the experience, you can literally get someone who is right next to you, right in your face, in terms of our children, because they don't know what is socially appropriate. And they don't know when it's time to make boundaries between one and another. Many of our children have issues in terms of language processing, receptive language, and expressive language. Therefore, if something does happen to them, they are not able, because they're not equipped, they don't have the skills to express whatever it is that is happening. Neither do they understand what is coming to them as well. They're vulnerable in social situations to trust and to befriend. And there was a statistic a couple of years ago that asked parents in the Jewish community about how much time they spent with children who have special needs. And basically the statistic reported that 80 to 90% of parents with special needs tended to use television as one of the things that they would distract their own child while they cared to the child's siblings. Well, when there's an opportunity for someone to trust and befriend one of our special kids, our kids pick up on it right away, and that's the first thing that they tend to do. And that puts them in a very vulnerable situation. The statistics that I read to you in the beginning goes with this as well, and that is that our vulnerable children are twice as vulnerable Our special children are twice as vulnerable as the regular population because of their disabilities. If you think that the story that you heard about here on Channel 4 is just one story, and it's a story that has happened just in Brooklyn and just in the Hasidic community, I'm here to tell you that it's not. I don't have the time to go over all of these stories, but I want to share some insights with you as well. Ben was a client that was seeing me who had developmental disabilities. And Ben, every Monday and Wednesday night, used to go to his local JCC, where his father would pick him up, would take him, the father would go use the gym a little bit, and Ben would go swimming and then use the sauna room as well. Well, what the father didn't know is that every Monday and Wednesday night, when Ben went swimming and then afterwards went to have the sauna as well, that there was a friend that Ben had. And Ben basically met this guy for a period of 2 years, where in the swimming pool of a Jewish community center of one of your communities, this guy would molest them every Monday and every Wednesday. And the father was in the Jewish center as well, did not pick up on it right away. This is one story. In Teaneck, New Jersey, we have a very major street called Cedar Lane, where there are many Jewish shops and Jewish services that are offered throughout Cedar Lane. I got a call a couple of months ago from a parent who was crying to me and telling me that they were in the police department. And what apparently happened was another special person basically began to drop his pants and to masturbate in public on Cedar Lane. And this is a major, major major street in Teaneck. And the police picked him up and arrested him because they're not allowed to do that. And I say to you that part of the problem is that our children are not aware. They don't have the knowledge to know what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. I will tell you also that since the Nefesh conference is coming up soon, I don't know if anyone here is associated with the Nefesh organization, which is the Orthodox Mental Health Organization, but 2 years ago when the Nefesh conference did run, there was a mother who spoke out about one of her children who left her a letter after he committed suicide, explaining that when he was 7 years old, he was molested for years and years by an uncle, and that because he couldn't deal with the trauma of the sexual abuse, he decided to take his own life. And the stories go on and on and on. And I really don't give them any justification by merely speaking the words, because I'm not sharing with you the feelings and the trauma experienced by some of our children. The need existed and still exists for a proactive intervention. And what basically happens is that there are some Jewish agencies like Ohel who have what's called responsive interventions. And what they do is they actually have groups and counseling sessions for people who have been sexually abused. The problem with that is, first of all, it's very limiting in terms of our own special population. And second of all, because it's responsive, it's not proactive. They deal with it after the fact, they don't deal with it beforehand. So what Sinai Special Needs Institute basically did is we got together and we tried to create a program called Project Self, which is Sexual Education for Life. And we began, we're doing this year, a pilot study in many of our schools, and that it's an educational program that is really geared to prevent the sexual abuse. And we'll speak to you a little bit about how that happened. But I do want to make mention that the RCBC has endorsed this project, and a special acknowledgement to Rabbi Neuberger and Rabbi Yudin, who have been working with me and Sinai in terms of making sure that everything in Project Self is geared to the most halacha standards and Torah hashkafa as well. Basically, Project Self is an educational program. It goes through 5 units where each of these units is discussed. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but if you want to find out more about it, I will share with you. Self and Others is a unit about where the child kind of gets to know who they are in relation to other people, in relation to their family. Sexual identity is when the child begins to formulate if they are male or female and what that means to them as well. Then we go into what's called the human body, where the child begins to learn different parts of the human body, not just the genital part, but everything. When we do put an emphasis on the reproductive part, we speak a little bit about private touch. We do this mostly individually, where we teach some of our students who are a little bit more sexually aware or sexually active, that it's important that they do things in a private way, that they do things in a way where it's appropriate, meaning that it's not in the middle of the street or it's not in the middle of the school and so on and so forth. And finally, the most important part of Project Self is what we call preventing abuse. And we basically teach them a strategy which we call no-go-tell strategy. And that is, if they're confronted in a situation where someone is going to approach them and touch them, and by this time they've already realized what is private to them, they say to the molester, no, then they run, they go, and they tell somebody else. That's called the no-go-tell strategy. And that's a little bit about Project Self. I'm going to spend a moment or two telling you a little bit about Sinai, because we've kind of heard the name a lot today. We heard a little bit about Kolanu. Sinai is a special education agency schools that run here in New Jersey, but really service more than 200 students from the tri-state area. We've had kids who come to us from out of town as well. and also with a range of different types of disabilities, ranging from learning disability, high functioning learning disability, to very severe developmental disabilities as well. Beyond the academic services, beyond special education, we do provide other services as well. Quickly, they are clinical services, occupational therapy for children who have issues in terms of fine and motor gross issues, speech services, counseling, both individual and group as well, supplemental instruction to those students who are either mainstreamed or need that extra help. Our program, I think, is well known for its individualized approach. Every child gets what's called an IEP, Individualized Educational Plan. And that basically means that if a child needs to be in a room with two other kids and a shadow and a teacher, then we will provide that. All of our program in every single classroom is geared to the needs of our children. And depending what that need is, that is basically what we will provide. Even though we have some funding issues, like all the other Jewish organization, somehow with Hashem's help and the board and everybody else, we make things happen. One of the things that we also do that's a little bit different than some of the things that are there is our vocational program, where we actually take kids out into the community to have a vocational experience. So they're not just learning academics, they're not part of a special education forum, but they're actually experiencing what that academics is. And finally, we have some adult programs for people with developmental disabilities as well. In preparation for today's panel, I was asked to leave you with something very tangible and something very concrete that you can take back to your communities. We spoke a little bit about sexual abuse, and I think hopefully that you are more aware about it today and that you know that there is some intervention, and hopefully there will be many more to come. But what can I leave you with that you can take back to your constituents? My message to you is that our children, our special needs children, are very vulnerable. They are capable of being hurt and wounded, and they need you to defend them. One of the things that you can do is you can validate and you can place value on special education. Parents who have children with special needs tend to shy away initially from special education because of the many issues that arise from it, namely shidduchim, worrying what's going to happen in years from now, the stigma of having a child with special needs, or sometimes just the inability to accept what reality is. And what ends up happening is some of our parents tend to push along those children who have special needs into an educational environment that is not geared for them. They go through school, they go through elementary school, they go through high school, and they are the ones who are sitting in the corner. And they are the ones who really don't understand what is going on in the classroom. And they are the ones that the teacher pities and therefore will give him a 65 or a 70 to get through. And what you end up with is a child who's graduated from high school, a special needs child who's graduated from high school, who really has had no skills that they can then use on. No skills in terms of vocational abilities, no skills in terms of how to respond to other people, and no academic skills that they can really use. Sitting in a Gemara Shir for an hour and a half and 2 hours is not going to cut it for some of our children. One young girl who we are now servicing, her name is Tamar, went through school till eighth grade in a regular yeshiva setting. She was also accepted to a very prestigious high school here in the Bergen County area, who took her in with the stipulation that she will have an aide as part of her research throughout her high school education. Well, clearly after the third, fourth month of this child being in the school realized that they made a terrible mistake, and that this child, Tamar, really could not handle a high school, let alone a high school that promoted intellectual types of academia. And this particular girl came to our school as well. When we tested her at ninth grade, this girl was testing at the second grade reading level. This is only one story. Part of the problem, and the problem exists today even with this girl's family, is that they are not willing to accept the fact that there is a stigma associated with having a child with special needs. It takes a certain amount of courage, it takes a certain amount of bravery, and we heard from you as well as from our earlier presentation that if you deny, if you are in the process of denial, then your child is not going to get far in terms of getting the services that he or she needs. So inclusion is very important, and we spoke about inclusion today as a lot. But special education is just as important. And I'm not saying that every special child needs special education, but some of our special children do. So what is your role, and what can you take back to your community? One, you can help parents accept the realities of their children's issues and disabilities. You can comfort them, but give them real practical advice, as we spoke about today. Two, you can encourage those parents to get information and to become educated consumers. There are a lot of programs out there. There are a lot of services out there. Parents do not know about them. Tell them, speak out in front of these parents. Three, when appropriate, then encourage parents to send their children to special education. I'm not stating that every child needs to go to special education. Far from it. And some children will do very well in a regular yeshiva setting. But there are some children who will really benefit from specialized education. You need to encourage your parents to do that as well. Final thing is that if you don't know what you can do for families who have children that have special needs, then just ask. And I think that there are plenty of resources in your booklets today, as well as you've gotten to know some of us as well. Now that we spoke a little bit about special education, I kind of want to give the podium over to Mark, who will speak to you a little bit about financing some of these programs.
Thank you. Thank you very much.